At Media 2007 podcast, hosted by Titan Internet, supporting At Media Ajax, taking place in London on the 19th and 20th of November.
Glad you could all come here. This is my second time at At Media. This year in 2005. If you don't know me, I'm from Toronto. I work in web accessibility for the moment. I wrote a book on web accessibility called Building Accessible Websites, which is now quite out of date, but these things happen in computer publishing. My topic today is when accessibility is not your problem. It's good to be here in Islington because, as it turns out, I can show you here. I should probably quit out of iChat, shouldn't I? It's happened. People have pinged you on instant messaging while you're on stage. You don't want that. It's a funny thing because we have a subway station in Toronto called Islington, which is way the hell out in the West End, far away from where I live. Behold the beauty of the city of Toronto. But of course it has the unique and storied custom typography found only on the Toronto subway. That's a typeface without a name or a lowercase, actually. I'll be back in Brighton in September to talk about that typography. And here is the bus bay of the Islington subway with its perhaps appropriate evil red glowing lights. All right. I should probably do the other thing. Since I'm here in Islington, there's something I read a lot. I read Private Eye every week, and I read all the cartoons, including the cartoon strip by Knife and Packer called It's Grim Up North, London, which is all about these two guys, Jez and Quinn, and their daughter Isolde, I believe, who live up here. Apparently, Islington is the place to go for fair trade coffee and Nicaraguan handicrafts and things like this. This is their incredibly hideous Flash-based website, knifeandpacker.com. It's a complete piece of crap. So the question is, which one am I, Jez or Quinn, right? Because there are parts of me in both of them, right? And don't say Isolde. And now we wait for Safari to close the window. Remember, what were they saying about if you have something in Flash, it takes over your entire browser? Of course, if it's Safari, you can just type your name and it takes over the whole browser. There we go. All right. So the performance problems in Safari are completely unreported, and I know Jan Hicks is here, and he wants to pimp his Safari, but can you pick something else? All right, the WCAG Samurai is ready for real. If you know, I wrote an article for Zeldman on A List Apart entitled To Hell with WCAG 2 last year, which described all the failures in Web Content Accessibility Guidelines version 2. I pledged at the time that I was starting a secret cadre of developers who would write errata for and corrections to WCAG 1. This WCAG Samurai was modeled after the CSS Samurai, which are, of course, modeled after the seven Samurais. So even though I'm a vegan and a pacifist, everyone seems to be talking about martial arts today. Dan Webb, Mark Bolton, me. You can't seem to get away from it. Well, it really is done. If you go to wcagsamurai.org, which you can't do right now, but when you get back to a place that has internet, you can go to wcagsamurai.org and read our corrections to WCAG 1. We developed this in a closed process because the so-called open process of the W3C really wasn't open. It was dominated by multinationals. One of the two co-chairs is a bully. Everything went wrong with it. I'm the only person ever to my knowledge, expelled from the WCAG working group, right? And it's not because I was an asshole, or as they say in British, arsehole. Everything's on the public record, and you can fact-check my arse about this. It's not because of that. So if their so-called open process wasn't really open, what's the option? Do a completely closed process. That's what we did. There was a secret group, and I won't be disclosing who was in that group. And we worked out these errata for WCAG 1. They're corrections to WCAG. They are not a replacement for WCAG. They have nothing to do with WCAG 2, right? And if you're an experienced standards compliant developer, you'll be surprised by almost nothing, right? It'll seem like old hat to you, in fact, right? But not everyone is a seasoned developer, and it will be new to some of them. So, as of today, just after lunch, actually, you can go to wcagsamurai.org and read the errata and print them out if you want. You can write in with suggestions or complaints or whatever. This is like the first time ever I can promise you I won't be oversensitive to things. You can just write in and say anything you want. This is a trial run, and the final version will be out in 3 weeks, right? I don't know if there'll be any more updates after that. We'll see how it goes, right? I'm not stating that either way. But that's not all. The WCAG Working Group would never have done all this work, all its work in secret. There's something else that we did that they would never do, send our work out for peer review. Surprise, surprise, we did exactly that. Behind everybody's back, I sent the WCAG Samurai out to Gian Sampson Wild, that's G-I-A-N, Sampson Wild, it's a woman, in Australia for review. She had no rules. She could write whatever she wanted, and she would do it in secret, and no one would be able to look at it until this moment. I haven't seen it. You haven't seen it. Only she knows what's in this peer review. So when you get to a place that has internet, if you go to samurai review.wordpress.com, you can jot that down later, but I'll put up a slide up in a sec. If you go to samurai review.wordpress.com, you can read what she wrote. It's a real peer review, and it's almost perfect, since the samurai didn't know this was happening, and she doesn't know who the samurai are, despite some suspicions of the contrary that she has. We did that. But there's more. Since I figured that people would criticize me for cherry-picking as my peer reviewer another critic of WCAG 2, I had a second peer review done. Which, you know, is the kind of thing that actually happens in science. So, yes, we have two peer reviews for the price of one. This peer review was done by Alistair Campbell of Nomensa here in London, who is probably in the audience. Don't identify yourself. You try to stay anonymous, right? Like, turn your badge over. And he had his own blog on which he could publish anything he wanted about this. And that one is reviewsamurai.wordpress.com. Just as with Gian Sampson Wild, I don't know what he wrote. You don't know what he wrote. It'll be a complete surprise once we all go to load it. So we had, not only did the samurai not know this review was taking place, the two reviewers didn't know that there were two reviewers. They thought they were the only reviewers. It was a secret to each other. I don't think you can get any close to independent standards development than that. So to recap, if I did my slides correctly, there we go. Oh, shit. You know, you realize how much effort I put into this? Hold on. Just a minute here. That's because it's on the other one. Hold on. And then we switch to Safari. Did you know that I'm the only person who doesn't use Keynote for presentations? I'm going to be showing you things from 5 different programs today. And you see how well it's going? And Tautek, put your hand down. It's not Q&A yet. Right. Okay, while we're waiting, okay, wcagsamurai.org, samurai-review.wordpress.com, reviewsamurai.wordpress.com. And you see, we're still waiting for Safari to come back. This is why you have to, you know, wait for things to go wrong in your presentations, because something always will. Fine. Why don't we let it do that on its own time? We'll come back to it at the end, for example. Okay. The open and closed project is my research project that I'm starting up back home, which is not related to web accessibility, except in as much as there is video on the web. Its main goal is to write a set of standards, that is, how-to manuals, for the 4 fields of audiovisual accessibility, which are captioning and subtitling, which are 2 separate things, not one, as you say in English and Irish English, and audio description and dubbing. So to go through those again so I don't stumble this time, captioning and subtitling and audio description and dubbing. There are no independently developed and user-tested standards for those 4 fields. So if you've ever watched captioning, or as it's mistakenly called in this country, subtitling on television, or if you've listened to audio description on television, or seen captioning or audio description at the movie theaters, there are no independently developed and user-tested standards that determined how those 2 things were carried out. Well, we're going to write those. To get myself going on this, I started a micro-patronage project, which wasn't about fundraising for the research project itself. It was to keep me afloat while I did the fundraising for the research project. This started back in November. About 215 people donated a total of about $5,800 American dollars into this project. How many people in the audience donated to my micro-patronage? That's a good showing, and you have my thanks. How many people didn't do that but did something like put up a banner ad or put up a blog post? Because there were many free of cost options, and there are some of you too. So you have my thanks for that. I did what I said. I got funding applications in to a couple of the large broadcasters in Canada, which are trying to swallow other broadcasters. And as part of that process, they have to divert 10% of the purchase price to social benefit spending. And this is the perfect thing for that. Besides, only need $4 to $7 million Canadian for the full project, which is peanuts. Now, things aren't going altogether well on that. I got a kick in the teeth by the Canadian broadcasting regulator, similar to Ofcom here in England, just 2 weeks ago, which I have to go back and spend like the month of June fighting. But, you know, hope springs eternal. Just as England will prevail, this project will prevail too, right? Now, you don't have to take notes. As ever, I post all my speaking notes with examples and links and all that on my website, joeclark.org/media7, which will have the combined notes from the San Francisco version of this talk and the London version, which are not exactly the same. They're about one-third different. By the way, while I've been muttering about how I can't get my slides to work here, slides are almost always optional in my presentations. You can get by just by listening to me or even reading the notes or reading a transcript. So if you're in the audience and you have a visual impairment, don't worry, you're not really missing anything from the slides. And please do send me email at joeclark@joeclark.org. I'm also on all the instant messaging systems. Okay, when accessibility is not your problem. What we're going to talk about today is the fact that the people who write web content, or authors as they're known, have been expected to carry almost the full weight of web accessibility. If you're the one creating the page, or if you're the one creating the page, you have to take care of pretty much everything if you want that page to be accessible, right? Or if you want it to pass certain guidelines, or if you want to avoid having people write in complaining that you didn't pass the guidelines, right? And, you know, I hate it when people write in criticizing the quality of other people's work. I mean, I hate it when pedants do that sort of thing. Pedant, by the way, is Canadian English pronunciation of pedant. Right? Anyway, the whole idea is nonsense. Web content does not magically transmit itself from the author to a site visitor or a site reader. There are a number of intermediaries along the way. Some of them aren't really important, like your actual web server. That doesn't have a whole lot to do with web accessibility. But some of them are very important, like the browser or assistive technology that a person with a disability is using. And when we're talking about browsers, we're not talking about your browsers, we're talking about theirs. So, I'm asking all of you to sign up to a new philosophy. It's not even that new. Like every week now, I'm seeing new blog posts about it. Patrick Lauka had one. Alistair Campbell has a whole set of them. The idea here is that it's actually very simple. If a browser or adaptive technology can handle an accessibility problem, I won't. Right? This is the pledge I want you to take as of today. You can say that in a really crude, punchy way. It's not my problem, because sometimes it isn't. So let's look at some examples. The biggest one is font resizing. Right? We've had a lot of discussion about typography today. But it just isn't your problem if any visitor, for any reason, whether they have a disability or not, prefers a different font size. It just isn't your problem. It still isn't your problem even if the visitor cannot use your page without having a different font size. It isn't your problem because you are not dictating the font size. You're merely suggesting the font size. This is why we have CSS, right? It's up to the browser and the adaptive technology to decide what the ultimate font size is going to be. Now, you find this problem expressed in a couple of ways, and people restate the same points over and over again until they seem like they're making sense, but they don't. So, for example, we're constantly told not to use pixels as a unit to size text, or we're told that pixels are an absolute unit and you must only use relative units. Usually we're told this by people who don't know there's such a thing as Firefox and haven't done their own research. Pixels are a relative unit by spec, right? And in reality, full stop. You can use them for anything in web design, full stop. You can use any unit for any purpose, because you are, in the context we're talking about now, you are merely suggesting the font size. It's up to the browser or the screen magnifier or whatever to pick the real size. Now, you usually won't use PX as a unit, because there are very few cases when type on a web page has to be a certain number of pixels high, right? Maybe the fine print at the bottom of the page that gives the copyright statement, that sort of thing. Standards compliant authors aren't going to use the PX unit very often because the semantics of the PX unit almost never come up in web design, right? If you run into a site that uses PX for a lot of text, that's going to be the least of your worries. It's like saying it's okay to use tables for layout as long as you use only one. Well, in the real world, the people who use tables for layout never use only one. There's 14 or 37, right? I did look at a site a couple of weeks ago where there were 37 tables for layout on one page, right? That's still happening in 2007. The kind of authors who use PX for sizing text are the ones who are doing everything else wrong, right? So if you're trying to pick on a standards compliant developer for using PX on one little block of text, a nav bar or something, then you're picking on the wrong people. Right, so there's the variation about this complaint about pixels. We're told not to use them because they can't be resized. Well, of course they can in every browser other than IE6 and IE7 on Windows. And incredibly enough, IE7 did not fix that. PX sized text still cannot be individually resized in IE7. You can zoom the whole page, but that's a different discussion. If you're using IE6 because you don't know there's such a thing as a browser, let alone more than one of them, right? Which is something that's easy for us as pros to ridicule, but we all had to learn that at some point that there was more than one browser. Well, then if you're like that, you need to have your grandkids over to download Firefox and tell you how to use it, right? Because your problem is you're using a crap browser, not that the authors have done anything wrong. If you're blind and your screen reader only works with IE6, which isn't true anymore anyway, then it doesn't matter what size the fonts are because you're blind. Right? If you're using a screen magnifier whose voice output only works with IE6, and there are still a couple of those, then font size is irrelevant because it's a screen magnifier and its entire purpose is to blow up the type size to something that's comfortable for you to read. And anyway, font resizing, as we know it, is an issue for non-disabled people or people who don't have a visual impairment, to be more accurate. People with really crap vision are already using a screen magnifier or a screen reader, right? So I dispute the idea that making your fonts even 50% bigger is really an accessibility issue. I dispute that it's a deal breaker for an actual person with a visual disability. If they're that visually impaired, they can't use the whole computer without help, let alone your website. The fact that your copyright notice is 9 pixels tall is not going to be a problem for them. It won't be make or break. Font size is just not your problem as an author. We wouldn't be using cascading style sheets if we didn't believe in the cascade. Right? Whoever visits your site has ultimate control over how it looks, even if they don't know that if they're using a broken browser. And if you're worried about text embedded in images, well, those can be zoomed too. Let's see what Opera can do for us today. For the hell of it, we'll see if we can get Safari to work. No, Safari's crashed for the afternoon. Sorry. Okay, yeah, I can force quit, yes, and I can do that right in front of you with 700 people watching, or I can just go ahead. I build these things in so I can live without the slides, right? Okay, so there's my website in Opera, which is, you know, the homepage of joeclark.org. You know, site to behold, photo by Jeremy Keith. That's great, isn't it? Okay, that's 100%. I can just press the plus key in Opera, and all the images keep getting bigger and bigger, along with all the text. And, of course, they also get smaller. You can go to ridiculously small, up to 1,000%. Now, the Opera page zoom works better than the IE7 page zoom, apparently. It's a proof of concept. Obviously, you can zoom the entire page, including text embedded in images. It's not really a problem. Right. Now, if you're worried about text inside Flash movies, yes, that's a nightmare, right? What business have you got talking about web standards or accessibility if you're putting lots of text inside Flash movies? Like, you're the wrong kind of people working on the wrong kind of internet, right? And now, if you're truly interested in making things better for people who really need big fonts, then what you should be doing is agitating for screen magnifiers to improve and produce really clear text. As far as I know, only Zoom Text version 9 blows up text correctly by repolling the original outline font file and asking for a new character at, say, 250 point. All the other ones take the existing bitmap that's already been derived from the outline font file, that might be 12 or 16 pixels high, and blows that up, right? So, of course, when people complain that you shouldn't put text in images because even if you blow the images up, it's all pixelated, well, all the text on your screen is already pixelated because everything but Zoom Text 9 blows up an already enlarged bitmap, right? So if you want things to improve for these low vision users when it comes to reading typography and having, you know, better access to zoomed text, then you should start there. Okay, now, what should really be happening with font resizing? Well, I got a list. Okay, one, every browser should have buttons on its toolbars by default to make text bigger or smaller, right? It should be there first time you run it until you take them off. I see Patrick H. Lauka agrees with me about that because he wrote a thing about web standards for webstandards.org where he mentioned it. First time you run the browser, it should tell you about those buttons on the toolbar and the keystroke equivalents for them. And you should be able to bookmark that page, because with many of these web programs, the first time you run them, there's a splash screen, you can never find it again, right? I'm not sure that the browser should ask you if you need accessibility. That's kind of a technical term. People who, you know, for example, senior citizens who have failing vision or something and are kind of in denial about it, they wouldn't know what the word meant. They wouldn't want to say yes anyway because that's stigmatizing. I don't think that really works. You should ask for the functional improvements that people need, right? People should be able to have resizable text for any... People who need resizable text for any reason, I should say, should never use IE6 or IE7, right? If you have a need for that, stop using those browsers. And if people write in and complain to you as a site developer that they can't resize your text, your font is too small, and you find out that they're using IE6 or IE7, then you should tell them to switch browsers. And if they say, I can't do that because the IT department has our entire computers locked down, then tell them they've nullified their own complaint and their beef is really with the IT department, right? Now, your page could have a help screen like the BBC's, which AbilityNet, whose representatives are here today, put together. The MyWeb, MyWay page, which explains how to use the accessibility features built into your own browsers on three different platforms. I think that could be a good idea. It's certainly not harmful. But 10 years into the web, is it really expecting much of people to know how to click buttons on a toolbar or press Control minus and Control plus? Is that really too much? I don't think so. Oh, and a browser should remember your text zoom settings per page or per website, sort of like the no squint extension Firefox does. So you won't always have to be doing that every time you go back to read the same blog. So all of this really does mean that you should never jimmy up your own font resizer for your own page, right? You should never have little make text bigger, make text smaller buttons. Just not, right? It's not your problem. Font resizing is not your problem. It's a browser problem. Okay, here's the next big one, is headings and links read out of context. One of the other vows I want you to take today is never to tell people to write headings or link text that make sense when pulled out of a document. This has been a completely incorrect idea since it came up, and not only is it dead wrong, it defies the actual web, right? So the idea is that some really cool adaptive technology, or a real dog like Jaws, will come along and, you know, mix and match your web page, right? It'll pull up a list of headings or a list of links. And, I mean, that's great. That's intrinsically useful. You can have a list of headings. You can go to one of them. It pops you right down to that part of the page. You can go to a certain link. That's fine, really. You know, it's great, okay? It's fine. The problem is that HTML and XHTML documents are structured in a tree, right? A node can have siblings or parents or children. That's why you can't put a paragraph inside a heading, right? But you can have a paragraph after a heading. There's a reason we have six heading levels, for example. It's not just because of the semantics of the document where H1 refers to the most important heading and H6 refers to the least important. It's the other reason is the document tree. And H3 has to follow an H2 or another H3. It just does. Now, if you think back to the olden days, people would mix and match heading levels on their pages because they didn't like the default styles of the higher level headings. They were too big and too bold. We told them to stop doing that. We told them to, learn the tools of their craft for a change and figure out that you could apply CSS to headings as well. Use headings in the correct order and the correct semantics, right? Well, we can't be a little bit pregnant. If we're insisting that people use headings in the right order, then we cannot also tell them to write heading text that makes sense in any order, right? This could be the stupidest advice in web accessibility, like the stupidest advice. And I don't know why it hasn't been killed off yet. If I'm the writer of the page, not the author of the site, the writer of the page, then I set up my headings because they must have those headings in a certain order, right? It's based solely on my decision, right, working from the semantics of the document. It's not your decision or the browser's decision or Jaws' decision, right? It's document semantics. And there's a corollary to this one. Some pedants want every heading on a page to have different text, pedant, of course, being the Canadian English pronunciation of pedant, and they absolutely insist, you know, like with foam coming out of their mouths, that link text has to be different in every case, and you can never have two links with different text pointing to the same thing, right? And this is all nonsense. I mean, these people don't get out much, I guess. So now what we're going to do, I'm going to waste everyone's time, restarting Safari. No, this thing wasn't working so well before. Okay. I have a wonderful product comparison page here. Now you get to see, you see my files and everything? Okay. Right. Product comparison chart. Very easy thing to work up on your own time. Let's see, yeah, even bigger font. See, it's a browser issue. Okay, let's take a look at this. All right, so I just jimmied this up. We were looking at three different sporty, expensive station wagons, brackets, estate cars, Saab, Mercedes, and a BMW. Those are all H1s. Fuel economy and safety is a topic of discussion in each one of them, so those are both H2s, but their fuel economy and safety are both shown three different times. Then we have unordered lists of links that send you to other specific pages for city and highway fuel economy, airbags, brakes, active safety, things like electronic stability control, and driving with kids. So all of those links, even though they're properly marked up in an unordered list, right, all have exactly the same link text and send you to different pages because, of course, each one of them refers to a different car. According to these advocates who insist that everything be different, you couldn't have fuel economy and safety repeated for each car, even though the sense of the document demands that they be exactly the same. There aren't N different ways of saying fuel economy or safety for N different cars, right? And the same applies to the links. Isn't it great when you get the programs to work? All right, fine. Okay, and another stronger point about link text. People who hate the web always tell us that we should group our links in little lists at the ends of our documents, right? Because that's supposedly accessible, right? But these people are enemies of our industry and they should really be shunned. Because a link is an inline element, right? And you can style it to look like a block level element, as I did in those product comparison pages. You can make them into little tabs, right? You can do whatever you want with CSS. But at root, since it's an inline element, a link is something you put inside running text, right? So you, the writer, not the author of the site, you, the writer, have a reasonable expectation that people will read your text and understand the link before they hit it, right? Of course, people skim through web pages. Yeah, of course, everyone here does that. We all do that, right? But people have to read the text around your link to understand where it's going. That's just a reasonable expectation. You're the writer. And as writers, you are not authorizing anyone else here or JAWS or whatever to remix your text, right? They don't rearrange the sentences, do they? No. It's your site, and you can put links wherever you want. Right? If somebody has some kind of toy or adaptive technology that takes your website and shakes it up like a pair of maracas, that's their problem. Right? To comply with web standards, you have to write a well-structured document. Your document is not structured anymore if someone could come along and firebomb it and turn it into a pile of sticks. And one more thing, the title attribute does count as information about a link. If your browser or adaptive technology cannot display or render the title attribute text, on a link or anything, then what you're using is broken. You, the author, are permitted to use title attribute. Now, most of the time you see them on links. You can put them on almost everything. Of course you can use the title attribute to add more information. That's what it's there for, advisory information according to the spec. Now, if somebody comes along with a broken browser or screen reader and can't read it, how is that your problem? Browser and screen reader manufacturers have had an awful long time to get this right. God knows we've been complaining about it enough, right? If they're coming along with a broken browser or adaptive technology, that's their problem. And if your complaint is that tooltips don't hold enough text and don't stay visible long enough, who said that title attribute has to be displayed as a tooltip? Right? Now, what is the real problem here? If I misunderstand a link, what's going to happen? I'm going to get a page I don't want. Unless it's porn or something, I can see a reason why you'd want to worry about that. I'll give you an example in a sec. Not of that. It's a way you can avoid it. Give an example of a way you can avoid it. But okay, you hit a link you don't know about, you get a page you don't want. Well, stop crying to mommy, okay? This is the web, this is not Club Med, you're going to make mistakes, right? So surely you must know how to click the back button or press a key, right? So if you hit a link and it takes you to the wrong place, you just go back, right? Now, if people would limit themselves to warning people about link texts where you're looking at sort of non-web content or it's sort of dangerous or upsetting in some way, that'd be fine. So links to PDF files should be really explicit. I have an example I can show you. Yes, these were the earls for the WCAG family. I'll bring them back to you in a sec, all right? Okay. So here's how I, So I like to link to PDFs. I always put the letters PDF inside the link text. Oh, geez, so did someone take a picture of that? Someone just took a picture of that. I can't believe that. That's so lame. this is the stupidest thing to take a picture of. Like you didn't really did do Jez and Quint and the Islington subway type and anything. I said, take a picture of this. God. Okay, look. So I always put the letters PDF inside the link text. I always the title attribute always begins with PDF colon, and I have the little known type attribute of application/PDF, right? This is somewhat overkill because if I were to be consistent with what I'm telling you about today, the browser should know just from seeing .pdf that it is a PDF and should warn me about these things, right? Even something like Safari on Macintosh that can just natively show you a PDF, it should warn you, right? But it's if you're linking to non-web content or porn or something that automatically plays sounds or an all-flash page, you know, something that's essentially antithetical to the web or non-web content, right, then you should warn people about that. That's fine, right? Okay. Next topic, abbreviations, acronyms, initialisms. I hope some of you were looking forward to this. This is the one you should take pictures of. And I really wish people would get off our backs about those three things. First of all, and I speak as a linguistics graduate, no one is ever, and a professional writer for 10 years, no one is ever going to come up with an agreeable definition of those three things. Abbreviations, acronyms, and initialisms are terms that will be fought over forever, right? They just will. And whenever there's an argument over these definitions, people are always trying to define one as the other, like they're trying to say that every initialism is really an acronym and every acronym is really an abbreviation, so you should just use ABBR in your markup. It's something circuitous like this is always at work, right? It doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter. Because in the real world, we have abbreviations, acronyms, initialisms, symbols, notations, and more than that, right? HTML is simply inadequate to mark up everything under the sun. HTML doesn't even have footnotes, and it was invented by physics engineers writing physics papers. Right? How can you expect there to be markup for every nuance of written language? So why are we arguing over what's an abbreviation and what's an acronym? Also, I find that this discussion shows a lack of scholarship. It seems that people with an axe to grind about this can only ever come up with computer terms as counterexamples, maybe because they're nerds. But I just went to my local public library, and I was able to find reference books like the Canadian Dictionary of Abbreviations by Therese Dobroslavich, good Canadian name, 1994. Yes. And since I'm a staunch defender of Canadian English, that's what I'm going to use here. Here are just a few examples from this dictionary. They get better, by the way. We didn't see the ones at the end. So an AMI MEC-E, where the ECH in MEC is lowercase, is an associate member of the Institution of Mechanical Engineers. That'd probably be the sort of thing you'd find at the end of a business card. But we mark up business cards now, don't we? We have entire microformats for that, don't we? Right? An AMUS is actually an associate of music. The IWTC, with the T lowercase, is the International Wheat Council. And M. Agar Dev Ek is a Master of Agricultural Development Economics. And then we get to the military ones, which are by far the best, right? You just spend all day looking at those. And the best one I found in that single source was Stanav-Forlant, which is all in uppercase, Standing Naval Force Atlantic in NATO. And the closer you get to the speaker, the more feedback you get. Let's try that again. Oh, there we are. All right, and AirTCon is an air traffic controller, although when I gave this part of the presentation in San Francisco, a former air traffic controller came up to me and said, no, we just call ourselves AirCons, right? How would you mark that up? Now, the pronunciation of this will vary by country, and I'm going to give you the Canadian English pronunciation. A PED Gen Surge is a specialist in pediatric general surgery. So that's just from that list. But let's look at some others. Some of these are technological terms, but these are never the ones that are pointed out by people with an axe to grind. A PEng in Canada is a professional engineer, right? And everyone who is a professional engineer has the legal right, under statute, to call themselves that on their business cards and elsewhere. VFib, you'll be familiar with from all the medical shows, ventricular fibrillation. It's a heart condition. COAX does not mean coax. It means coax, as in coaxial cable, your old analog television cable. CBIT is a technology fair in Germany every year, but it's big C, small e, big B, big I, big T. PICT, all in capitals, is an old Macintosh file format. That is the full name. It is not an acronym. That is the full name, and that's how it's written. Many of you in the audience will have a phone called a Moto Razr, big M, small O-T-O, and then all caps, R-A-Z-R, right? And, of course, the best one ever is the blonde Russian pop-singing duo, Tattoo, who were famous for 14 and a half minutes in roughly 2002. And the official orthography of that group's name is small t dot, big A dot, big T dot, small U dot, right? Tattoo. How do you get Tattoo out of that? Now, looking at these things, do you honestly think that HTML, ABBR, and acronym markup is sufficient for all these things? No, I don't think so. And it gets even worse if you come from a multilingual country. Here's the homepage. I'll just zoom the hell out of it. Of the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade Canada, which is the Ministère des Affaires étrangères et Commerce International du Canada. And of course, there's, because it's government, there are acronyms. So the official acronym for this ministry is DFAIT-MAECI, which looks like it isn't any language. Is that half French? Is that like DFAIT-MAECI? I'm not exactly sure. That seems to be a relatively easy example. If you had to mark that up, you could do, I don't know, acronym DFAIT hyphen acronym lang equals French, MAECI. Well, that seems a bit pointless to me. That's a not very tricky example. But what about the Ministry of Canadian Heritage? Somewhat Orwellian name, but it actually deals with museums and copyright and things like that. Canadian Heritage in French is patrimoine canadien, and patrimoine is a very strange word and is masculine. The official acronym for the Department of Canadian Heritage, Ministère du Patrimoine Canadien, is just PCH. So they're using the C to double up on both languages. Is it patrimoine canadien heritage, or is it patrimoine Canadian heritage? The C is doubled up. It's bilingual. How do you mark that up in HTML? The answer is you don't, right? Our markup is insufficient for the real world. And the WCAG requirements do not actually achieve accessibility. You're supposed to specify the abbreviation, the expansion of an abbreviation or acronym the first time it occurs. You can do that any number of ways. You don't have to use title, right? But what if the abbreviation or acronym doesn't have an expansion? Does TV have an expansion anymore? How about DVD, right? That's actually a really special case because DVD officially doesn't have an expansion. They couldn't agree on one. How about MP3, right? What if the expansion is widely unknown or just irrelevant and it comes from another language? Yes, now we've been called to order, thank you. Examples are IE, that is lowercase I dot lowercase E, or EG or QED. If you use the expansions of those, no one would understand what you mean. Those have become fossilized forms in and of themselves. How about ABS for anti-lock brakes, going back to car safety? Shouldn't that be ALB? Well, no, because ABS is actually German. It's Anti-Blockier System. It's a German acronym that we use in English. How about diseases and microorganisms? How about E. coli and C. difficile? Do you really care what the E in E. coli stands for? No. If someone gave it to you, would it help you? No. Right? Yes, I suppose that was unintentionally ambiguous. If someone gave you the expansion of the E in E. coli... Anyway, the WCAG requirement also ignores the fact that you can jump into a document at any point. We know we have troubles with that in IE6 because of a little proprietary property they have that we only found out about 2 years ago. But it is still possible to go directly into a certain point in a document. And if you do that, you've missed the expansion, which according to WCAG has to be done in the first instance. It could have been way up in the first line of the document. And in any event, if you don't understand an abbreviation or acronym, why is it the page author's responsibility to make it clear for you? Why can't you look it up? Why can't you Google it? If that seems like a really hard thing to do, especially for someone with a cognitive disability, why don't you get them a good browser where they can just double-click a word and look it up immediately by right-clicking after that? It could be easily done. Why don't they use another browser, which I'll talk about, or adaptive technology I'll talk about later. Who told you that you had the right to understand every single word, sentence, page, or paragraph on a page, right? Whoever told you you had that right? Some things are going to be unclear, and sometimes that lack of clarity is built into the written language, right? Our markup can't fix that. Anyway, this all boils down to a failure of software. Screen readers should be including well-developed exception dictionaries by now, but of course they don't. I mean, they couldn't even pronounce homographs reliably for many years. Homographs are like cokes and coax, as I showed up there. Same spelling, different pronunciations, or deliberate, deliberate, right? An easier one in English is R-E-A-D. Is that read or read? Depends, right? Those are homographs, right? That comes up in our work as accessibilitistas. You'll be familiar with the skip navigation links, and for a long time the preferred terminology was skip to content. And of course this was mispronounced by many screen readers, including JAWS, as skip to content, right? Because it picked the wrong homograph. It picked the wrong pronunciation of the same spelling. So we work in an industry where we expect people with disabilities, who have a much higher rate of unemployment than non-disabled people, to shell out hundreds or thousands of dollars for these extra devices that just make their computer or browser usable, right? Barely get them to the same level as a non-disabled person. Then we find out that these screen readers cannot even read text properly, right? And suddenly it becomes our problem as page authors to correct that, right? No, I don't think so. It might help if some of these screen reader manufacturers had writers or linguists on staff, and I speak as both. It might be too much to expect for these software makers to come up with really good exception dictionaries. In English, abbreviations and acronyms are usually really easy to spot. Even if you use some of the old British house styles that leave off periods, whether you do or not, you can still spot these things because they have definite patterns, like periods or hyphens or odd capitalization, right? Or they only happen in certain predictable ways, places in sentences. Here, I'll give you another example using one of the other programs I've got going today. The question is, will this one crash? Okay, here's the main drag of the University of Toronto, St. George Street, right? St. George Street in British, I guess. This is the old style, one of the old style Toronto street signs. Notice that it has a three-dimensional object with a little acorn on the top. People have fought over the acorns. The acorn is the distinctive Toronto feature, right? Give it a rest. Anyway, all capitals, ST period George, ST period. It's the same abbreviation, front and back, but obviously it can't be St. George Street. It can only be, Street George Saint. It cannot be Street George Saint. It can only be St. George Street, right? And for reference, I'll show you the new style. These are attached only to light standards and traffic lights, which uses the clear view font in upper and lowercase. ST period George ST, right? Well, that would give you another clue, actually, if you were a device trying to read these things. Even though that's using the same abbreviation twice in three words, context tells you what it should be. And if we can figure this out, computers can be programmed to figure that out themselves. Anyway, this is not as easy in other languages. I can give you an example from Italian. I should be able to give you an example from Italian. This is me pushing the arrow key in Safari and not getting anything. Here we go. Hold on. Did you know this happened in Vancouver? Like, I had a perfectly validated S5 page in Vancouver, and it also didn't work. The example in Italian is SPA, big S, small p, big A. Società per azioni. It's a legal company designation like limited or PLC, but it looks like the word spa because it's just SPA, right? Now, I have some German speakers here today. Is there a German speaker who'd like to come up and assist me with this? Oh, I don't know. How about Patrick Lauka? Ladies and gentlemen, Patrick Lauka. Okay, now Patrick's going to need a mic, by the way, preferably one that doesn't cause feedback with mine. Your task is to correctly pronounce those three words.
Right, just the German bit.
Yes, then just only the ones in parens.
Okay. Größter anzunehmender Unfall.
Ladies and gentlemen, meine Herren und Damen, Patrick Lauka, right. Größter anzunehmender Unfall is G-A-U in capitals, right? It's a commonly used expression, like S-O-L, that sort of thing. It means worst case scenario. But big G, small a, small u is an older term for county or state. In these other, in these foreign languages, Italian and German, there are still predictable patterns of when these seemingly confusable abbreviations or acronyms occur, and software should be able to tell those things apart. Do you really think we should have to knock ourselves out trying to use just the right HTML markup to make those things clear? No, the software should be doing it. Now, I asked people at Freedom Scientific, they make JAWS, and GW Micro, they make WindowEyes, to tell me about how they develop their exception dictionaries for abbreviations and acronyms, and I didn't get a response, of course. So the question then becomes, what about VoiceOver on Macintosh, since many of us in the audience are Macintosh supremacists? What I'm showing to you now is the entire list of pronunciation exceptions in VoiceOver on Mac. 802.11b and g, two smileys, GIF, GUI, SMPTE, how often have you ever written that, and the three letters SQL, for which it gives the pronunciation SQL. That's not how I pronounce it. How many people in the audience pronounce SQL as SQL? Okay, how many just say SQL? Slightly more with SQL. See, so that's in dispute, isn't it? Right? Mac OS X comes with a built-in screen reader. You don't have to spend extra money. That puts you on a level playing field. It's a version 1.0 product. It works in a lot of ways. That's fine. It's still a good thing that you don't have to pay money for it, but you get this completely crappy and inadequate set of exceptions built in. I filed a bug on that, and nothing happened. Right. Now, I don't have perfect advice on how to resolve this topic. I only have partial advice. I think you should always stick to HTML semantics at root, right? You should use abbreviations, ABBR for abbreviations, and acronym for acronyms. If what you have isn't one of those things, that's fine, right? You should only specify expansions if a reasonable reader would not understand what they are. And you can specify expansions any number of ways, not just by using title. Your goal should be avoiding confusion, right? Not just trying to comply with someone's idea of an accessibility guideline. And you have to take into account what a reasonable reader is. If you're writing a public health site, you never have to spell out the E in E. coli, right? Now, one must eat his own dog food sometimes. And I check my own documents. So on my personal weblog, for example, I used acronym without expansion 149 times, and with expansion 93 times. So most of the time I don't expand acronym. I used ABBR without expansion 46 times, and with expansion 200 times. Most of the time I do expand ABBR, and I added a specific language code twice. And by the way, we're solving this in accessible PDF. We're doing it the correct way. PDFs are binary files and can contain little databases. PDFs actually are little databases. So we've decided that we're that abbreviations and acronyms will be handled by little lookup tables. So any number of abbreviations and acronyms can point to any number of expanded forms. So in St. George Street, the two instances of ST or ST period can point to two different expansions in the lookup table. And you, the user, with whatever software you're using, which will probably include just plain old Acrobat, can ask for an expansion on demand and it will get the right one. HTML can't do that, and maybe we should stop trying so hard. All right, last and not least, the only advice that WCAG 1 has for cognitive disabilities, right? Let me give you one of the little catchphrases of web accessibility, and we do have catchphrases, right? It is, we can make a website work with zero hearing, we can make one work with zero vision. We can even make a website work with almost zero movement. But we can't make a website work with zero cognition, right? And that's kind of unfair, because almost never do you find someone who has nothing of the particular sensor ability that makes them require accessibility. We deal a lot with totally blind people, perhaps more than we should. They get too much attention. But on the whole, people with disabilities have some residual ability, right? So it's not really a fair thing to say. It is just a catchphrase, right? And it's very true of cognitive disabilities like dyslexia, right? It isn't true that these cognitive disabilities are nicely tied up packages and the only thing you have wrong with you is you have trouble reading. Some of them have other effects like short-term memory loss, right? But for our purposes, right, the fact that you have a cognitive disability is just one thing. It's one thing we know about you. It doesn't say anything about whether you can understand our topic or, you know, have other competencies in life. For our purposes, as people working in web accessibility, we're only concerned that you have that one particular accessibility problem, right? So, my issue here is that advocates for accessibility for people with cognitive disabilities don't seem to be interested in isolating their advice the way we understand the disability is isolated. We understand that if we know you have dyslexia, then we know just one fact about you and nothing else. But the advocates for the cognitively disabled seem to think there's only one kind of web, and it needs to be completely overthrown, right, to satisfy their own demands. And there seems to be an effort to apply the WCAG 1 guidelines across the board. Now, WCAG 1 doesn't totally back that up if you read it accurately, but the only real guideline that pertains to learning disabilities does tend to be applied in real life on the real web. So, WCAG 1, checkpoint 14.1, says, use the clearest and simplest language appropriate for a site's content. People tend to overlook the bit at the end, appropriate for a site's content. They tend to write pedantic emails to site owners complaining about that the writing of the site wasn't clear enough, right? Or if they go beyond the WCAG guidelines, which is a pretty simple thing to do, they write in and complain to you that there's too much allusion or sarcasm or other non-obvious writing forms, and those are allegedly hard to understand. Now, if you're advocating for increased accessibility for dyslexics or anyone else with a learning disability, then every site tends to look like a nail and all you have is a hammer. That's the problem I'm talking about today. In general web accessibility, we can ask that every picture on the web have an alt text, right, or a text equivalent of some kind. We can ask for really good web semantics, and that includes really good forms. We can ask for captioning and audio description, video, but we can't ask every site to write simply. Right? I'm not the first person to say this, but whenever people bring it up, they tend to mention the original use of the web, which was to write physics papers for a physics laboratory, right? Or they use computer technology itself as an example of something that can't really be made clear or simple. But as with the abbreviation acronym case, that's too facile, really. If you think that every site on the web can be written clearly and simple, maybe you need to look at sites that talk about specific topics that are narrowly focused on that topic. And what we're going to do is look at one now, and that obscure, limited, vertical market topic is gardening. Yes, which everyone who has a square inch of land likes to do. Okay. Here's a page from the Royal Horticultural Society. Yes, and I should be able to fit to width here. Another useful feature of Opera. So that you may look at that if you wish or not. this page is about a plant disease called sudden oak death, which sounds like a great name for a rock band, right? Okay. And here we go. Pathogens. Phytophthora ramorum, ramorum blight, properly known as sudden oak death, and P. carnivae. The former occurs in Europe and in western USA. The latter is a previously unknown species occurring at only a few sites in the UK, mostly in Cornwall, where it was discovered during surveys for P. ramorum. Neither are native to Europe or the USA, but their origins are unknown. Problem. Leaf, stem, and bark infections on various native and garden trees and shrubs. Both species are frequent on rhododendrons. Viburnums are a major host of P. ramorum only. Bark canker, caused by P. ramorum, was recently discovered at a single site on Quercus petraeae, the first record on a native English oak. Cankers on trees have been relatively rare, and most are associated with heavy leaf infection on understory rhododendrons. So that was a site about gardening, right? You could clean it up a little. Anyone who's had a first-year college university writing course could do some things to make that easier. You could make the references easier to understand. You could avoid using terms like the former and the latter, right? But these organisms do not have everyday names. You would just have to keep using the Latin designations merely to accurately describe what is going on with this pathogen. And even the common names of many plants are large and unwieldy, like rhododendrons and viburnums. Oh, Richard Ishida's chrysanthemums from today. That's another long word, right? This is a page that is probably impossible to make accessible to people with cognitive disabilities, people with a wide range of them at least, right? This is not a claim that you cannot make this information understandable to a person with a cognitive disability. You just wouldn't be able to use the web for it, right? Perhaps this is the sort of thing that a gardening show should explain, right? Perhaps this is the sort of thing that one should have a book on tape for. Right? Perhaps this is the sort of thing that there should be a book on tape and a bunch of photos. Perhaps this should be a podcast that you can download that has chapter markings that are pictures that you can look at on your iPod. Right? You have any number of ways to make the information accessible. I don't think you can make this page accessible to a wide range of people with cognitive disabilities. And this is as mainstream as it gets. This is an information site about gardening from a century-old society that was endorsed by the royal family. You can barely come up with a more mainstream example. What are some other examples? Well, obviously blogs. There are millions of those now, right? And most of them are all about expressing oneself. There are different kinds of blogs, but really most of them are about personal expression, right? And a lot of people who are bad writers go out and write them anyway, right? That's fine. They should. And why not? They can. That's what we can do now. Everyone has a printing press. So I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that, you know, while we may insist on good HTML and good alt text and this sort of thing, even for those personal blogs, because those things don't really interfere with personal expression in a big way, right? We can't go around and tell blog authors to write in a certain way. We just can't, right? It may be true that personal blogs, by their nature, are inapplicable to accessibility guidelines for people with cognitive disabilities. Not exempt, inapplicable. It's not as though we should be in that category, but we're letting you off. It's no, you're not in that category at all, right? They're just not the kind of sites that should apply to those guidelines. How about news sites, including wire services? Sometimes you see the same story on 10 different sites. Ordinarily, under their licensing agreement, they can't substantially rewrite the story. They can do simple things like converting Fahrenheit temperatures into Celsius, right? But wire service stories and news articles are going to have difficult terminology. They're going to have people's personal names. They're going to have the exact legal terminology of criminal charges, right? What about transactional sites? A catalog of items may have to use the exact names for those items. Literary sites, if you publish your own journalism or fiction, you shouldn't have to rewrite it. Those are just some examples of sites where accessibility for cognitive disabilities may be inapplicable. But the question is, when are they applicable? If the topic of this presentation is when accessibility is not your problem, when is it your problem? Well, I have some ideas. I think official or company blogs should comply with any accessibility guidelines for cognitive disabilities that happen to come out. Maybe not, you know, thousands of individual blogs at Microsoft, but if you're a small company and you have one official blog, it should be applicable, right? I think information sites of all kinds should be applicable, and that runs the gamut from government sites to private sector sites to multinational corporations. You should be able to look at a page that describes a lawnmower, and everyone should be able to understand it, right? I mean, even if you have trouble reading, you should still be able to understand it. Every kind of mapping or directions site should be usable by someone with a cognitive disability. And there are lots of fun things you can do there, actually, that really haven't been tried. So your subway trip planner has to work for everybody, right? A site that people with disabilities could use as a replacement for a site that would use a lot of text has to be applicable to these guidelines. If you have a site that makes it easy to publish a recording, like a podcast or a video, which might be easier for you if you have trouble writing, then that site itself has to be applicable to these guidelines. This is a slippery slope toward making sites that are intended for disabled people super accessible while the rest of their web is crap, but that's not what I'm saying. Right? I'm just saying this is a category of site that would be applicable to these guidelines. And I think if you have a web application and you want to make it more accessible and you produce a so-called simple version, you should never eliminate the so-called regular version, right? Because even the people who start out with a simple version, whether they have a cognitive disability or not, or any kind of disability for that matter, may want to go back to the regular one for different things. After a while, you learn shortcuts, right? The fact that you may have difficulty reading doesn't mean you can't figure out how to click a certain link on the faster page. You shouldn't necessarily, if you custom crafted a simple site, you shouldn't get rid of the other one, right? Now, let's talk about technology. That is the theme of this presentation. I think it's way too hard to write clearly and simply. You can learn to write just by writing, right? Reading and writing, right? That's classic advice. But the writing tools to make it easier to write clearly and simply are just non-existent. There's just nothing, right? And I'm not talking about the grammar checker in Microsoft Word. Plain English is harder than complicated English. And if you want to use markup to make your complex sentences accessible, like maybe by including explanations of allusions and sarcasm, you really don't have anything that will help you there at all. And this is the perfect place for a microformat. This would be just the right place to use a spanner, a div with a certain regimented class of regimented set of class names like metaphor or double meaning. And then you, the page author, or you, the viewer, could style those in a certain way, right? And this would be a good place to use CSS cursor styles like cursor help. I think Lisa Seaman, who is a British subject who lives down in Israel, has been talking about improving authoring tools in this way and putting markup in for non-obvious writing techniques like sarcasm and allusion. Now we have a relatively easy way to do it, microformats. And it's my experience that almost nobody knows that there are custom screen readers just for people with learning disabilities. Right? A company that was founded by the genius who invented the reading machine, Ray Kurzweil, is still a producer of these things. Right? Actually, the big thing that Ray Kurzweil invented was not the reading machine part, but the optical character recognition part. He invented a computer that could read any font that wasn't cursive. He doesn't own the company anymore. He's now a best-selling author and is widely regarded as one of the great geniuses of the 20th century, and he's still alive. But the company that still bears his name, Kurzweil Educational Systems, Kurzweil EDU, has a whole line of screen readers that are customized for people with learning disabilities. They do things like read sentences out loud while highlighting the words they're reading, or just isolating a couple of lines, right? And these are useful things, right? Anyway, yes? Oh, yeah, well, I'm running out of time. Okay, browsers could be improved, right? We can make the default no style sheet view a bit nicer, because sometimes people with cognitive disabilities give up and just turn style sheets off, which means that they're sort of, you know, hanging there by a thread trying to figure out how to use the page, right? And we could use much better fonts in these default style sheets, because this far into the web, I don't see why the default style sheet has to be, you know, bold Times Roman all over the place, right? So these are the sorts of things that can be easily done by hardware and software manufacturers to improve the lot for people with cognitive disabilities, because most of the time, that's not your problem. Okay, thanks, bye.